You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Bob. Thank you. Happy to be with you here.
Well, I'm happy to have you. Let me introduce you. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter, to which everyone should subscribe. This is the Non-Zero Podcast, to which everyone should subscribe. You are Scott Horton. For one thing, you are host of your own thing, the Scott Horton Show, which there's a podcast version of, which I've been known to listen to. You're also editorial director of antiwar.com. And you are author of the book we're going to talk about, which is called Provoked: How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. Congratulations on the book. You enjoying the promotional process?
Thank you. No. I mean, yes, I love doing podcasts and stuff like this and talking to people. And, you know, that's my thing, is trying to spread the message. Of course, that's why I wrote the book. So, yes, I am happy to promote the thing. And at least I don't have to write it anymore. So that part is over.
That part's over. The so antiwar.com, for people who don't know, you want to talk a little about kind of the ideological lineage and so on of that and of you?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that. So antiwar.com was founded by Eric Garris and Justin Raimondo in 1995.
The late Justin Raimondo.
The late
who
great
died,
Justin
Raimondo. Two, 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
Actually, a little bit longer now. It was in the summer, early summer of 2019 that he died.
Okay.
And so Justin, who is essentially my mentor there, he, and I'm now in his chair as editorial director, he was the protege of Murray Rothbard, who is considered to be the primary, if there is a primary, he would be it, the primary founder of modern American post-war, that is post-World War II libertarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are in our own ways rejects of from the right. We're radicals for capitalism and right-wing hippies and whatever you, that was what Ayn Rand called us, libertarians. We're one of the first major important, I think this may have been the first important Rothbard piece I ever read, was called Confessions of a Right-Wing Liberal. Hmm. And it's about how he says, well, the world's gone crazy because I used to be a far right-wing extremist because me and all my buddies, we all hated FDR and the war. And then, but now I guess I'm a left-wing extremist because I'm palling around with a bunch of Maoists trying to stop the war in Vietnam. This would have been in the early 60s that he wrote this.
So Rothbard was against World War II involvement?
Well, certainly before Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say I'm like a real expert on his takes like all around that time. But certainly the old right coalition at that time, it, you know, the right was not always synonymous with conservatism. The conservatives were part of the right, but the right was essentially everybody who hated FDR and wanted to stay out of the war. And now after Pearl Harbor, virtually all of them said, well, Hitler declared war on us. So what do you think is going to happen then? So that's,
I mean, if they're going to get all pissed off about an oil embargo, this is, we're going to go.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, the Japanese did attack us first and Hitler declared war on us first in that case. But so that changed a lot of things. But then so after the war, essentially, you know, we talk about the neoconservatives like they really were an advent of the W. Bush era or whatever, but really, the neoconservatives took over conservatism more or less from the beginning. And this is told very well by Rothbard in his book, The Betrayal of the Old Right, and by Justin Raimondo in his book, Reclaiming the American Right, The Lost Legacy of the Conservative Movement. And this is about how, well, essentially, all of the old right, sort of non-interventionist, anti-central government, anti-central banking type guys, had essentially grown old and retired or died through the time of the war. And so in the early post-war era, you had people like Russell Kirk and especially William F. Buckley come to define conservatism. And essentially, the real conservatives were against the Cold War because even though, of course, they were anti-communists, they were also against strong national government here. And Buckley had famously written in the Commonweal magazine in an article called The Party in the Deep Blue Sea, he said that in order to fight the Cold War against the Soviet Union, we must accept a totalitarian bureaucracy on our shores, even with Truman at the reins of it all, in order to fight off the Reds. And the parts of the right who rejected that were exiled from the National Review by Buckley, who then brought in a bunch of commies, frankly, a bunch of ex-Trotskyites like Sidney Hook and James Burnham and Whitaker Chambers and all of these guys to come in and lead the right, because a lot of them were Trotskyites. They hated the Soviet Union because, of course, Stalin had betrayed Trotsky and all that. And plus, they were Americans. So they signed up with the war party and helped to define conservatism throughout the Cold War era. And Justin, Rothbard and Justin Raimondo both do such a great job of showing the avenues of the different groups of neoconservatives. This is a very narrow definition. This is, we're talking like 100 men, 150 men or something over two or three generations, and women too, who were the neoconservatives, you know, from this time, and how, you know, through Leo Strauss and Wohlstetter at the University of Chicago, through Max Schachtman and the Social Democrats USA, through the Podhoretz clan and the Crystal clan, and through then Scoop Jackson, the senator from Boeing, and, mm-hmm. and then on into the Reagan administration. And they show how these guys moved from the radical left to the right. And it was essentially a rejection of essentially the wokeism of the time, right? The hippie era of the late 60s, the rejection of the Vietnam War and the promotion of the civil rights movement. And also importantly, the rejection of the 67 war by the new left in America. And that was a big part of why the neoconservatives started to move to the right and became really, you know, ensconced in the Reagan administration. And we know them most famously as the Axis of Crystal, as Justin called it, the men who lied us into Iraq War II from inside W. Bush's government and from the National Review, the Weekly Standard, the Wall Street Journal, and the rest.
Okay, well, that you covered a lot of ground there.
So that's antiwar.com. We're the nemesis of the neocons.
Okay. I actually saw a clip of a video with you and Bill Kristol was, you know, he's been on my podcast, I think admirably, because I don't agree with him. And he was on the stage with you. I guess this was recently taped.
2 years ago.
That was a couple of years ago. So anyway, that was circulating on Twitter. So I, for anyone who doesn't know and cares, I am more somewhere left of center, but there's a certain amount of overlap between my view of foreign policy and yours, although there are important differences between left and right that maybe we'll get to. But one thing I have said to people that I think you'd agree with is, you know, I think if America's foreign policy had been enlightened, more enlightened, maybe we could have avoided this Ukraine war. And people say, well, what should we have done differently? And I say, well, actually, it's a long story because I'm talking about decades. And now, Scott, you have written that story, at least your version of the story, making mm-hmm. a similar argument that since the end of the Cold War, or at least not long thereafter, mm-hmm. The U.S. has done a series of things that, in retrospect, made some sort of disaster like the Ukraine war more likely. I think you'd go along with that much probably. And
sir.
And if I could, why don't we start out? So I want to, you know, give you a chance to kind of tell the story. Why don't we start out with the word provoked? Because sure. The title of the book, because, you know, people use that to mean different things, to have different moral implications. Some people might say, you know, well, he was provoked into hitting the guy, and by that they might mean he bears no moral responsibility, or maybe he bears no legal responsibility, or maybe he doesn't bear either, or they might mean, no, actually, I'm not letting him totally off the hook, but the fact is, if the guy hadn't done this, you know, blah, blah, blah. So when right. you say that in some sense Russia was provoked into invading Ukraine, what do you mean by that exactly?
I like the way you frame that. It really can mean there's a lot of different implications depending on maybe even the way you enunciate it or who knows what, right? So no, I am certainly not saying that it was justified. I am saying that America, essentially Washington, as I say in the subtitle, not our country, our government's leaders, put the Russians in a position where they essentially decided their choice was to fight now or to fight later when it's going to be more difficult. And that's mm-hmm. essentially it. I quote, I'm sorry, I forget the man's name, but there's a great professor at Fancy Pants College in England who wrote a big study saying essentially the same thing. And there's all the different, you know, citations and in context, not just Russian talking points and excuses, but real discussions about what's happening here. where essentially the bottom line, to skip the last 30 years and get to the bottom line, America was making Ukraine a de facto member of NATO. We're ensconcing our government throughout their government in a way that's all like pretty hard to believe. If you didn't have Nuland's testimony describing it before the Senate, you wouldn't believe it.
This is Victoria Nuland, who was in the State Department during the Maidan Revolution and various other times.
Mm-hmm. And who is Robert Kagan's wife, Robert Kagan, who is Bill Kristol's writing partner and founder of the doctrine of benevolent global hegemony, a key neoconservative, his brother Fred, and he both promoted the Iraq and Afghan wars and surges. And Fred's wife runs the Institute for the Study of War. Their father, Donald, was an anti-communist, crusader, neocon back in earlier days. So a very prominent war party family there. And Nuland explained, I quote this in the book, she's the best source I know about this, where she explained that they ensconce civilian American officials throughout the Ukrainian government, through their Justice Department, through their Treasury, through their foreign policy, through their everything. We have Americans picking and choosing people to hold offices inside their government in a way. They call it shared sovereignty, the kind of thing that is just almost unbelievable. And then more importantly, they were continually promising avowedly that we will make Ukraine a member of the NATO alliance. They will sooner or later, maybe even sooner, they will have an Article 5 guarantee from the United States and our other Western European allies that we would fight for them in a war. And at the same time, all along, expanding what they called military interoperability, which just means standardizing their military to use NATO weapons, NATO rounds, NATO strategy, NATO communications equipment, so that they can be essentially integrated into the Western alliance's order of battle, even if without that Article 5 guarantee. So this is not an argument for giving them an Article 5 guarantee, but I'm describing what even a lot of scholars from the big universities and think tanks have said was really the worst of both worlds, because we're really saying, hey, you and him fight, but we're not really willing to jump in and help you. And we know he's a lot bigger than you, but we want to do this anyway because we think you'll get some good licks in, and we like seeing him get a black eye.
Okay.
And so that's essentially the thinking behind the policy.
Okay. So let me... I want to isolate one issue and just kind of highlight it, and then maybe start earlier in your narrative. But as long as we're talking about Victoria Nuland, I mentioned the 2014 Maidan Revolution, where the president of Ukraine was deposed. I think it's fair to say, and fled, I guess, for fear of his life, you could say, and so you could say he was violently deposed. I mean, the terminology is very controversial. In fact, specifically, the question I want to get to, somebody asked me just the other day, like, so would you say that the U.S. or the West or something orchestrated a coup in Ukraine in 2014? And I said, well, actually, I don't know enough to put it quite that way. That suggests a lot in the way of coordination and planning. I can point to things that the West did that made such a thing more likely, including the active encouragement of and subsidy of a movement that led to and blah, blah, blah. But I said, like, orchestrating a coup, I don't think I can go that far. Based on what I know, I'm curious as to how you characterize what happened in 2014.
Well, again, I appreciate your complicated way of even asking it, because it is a complicated way to explain. I guess my first answer would be, I don't speak French. I know there's lots of different kind of coup days, this and that. For example, what Saddam Hussein did when James Baker invited him into Kuwait in 1990 was called a coup de main, or that's what Putin did in Crimea in 2014. A coup de main. That's where it's one swift, successful surprise attack, and now you rule the place. It might not even be a big battle, right? Like in Crimea, there was only 6 people killed and the whole thing's over. So then there's a coup d'etat, which I think is more like your generalissimo overthrows your presidente, right? So this is what, and I guess this is French too, this is what I think they call a putsch, P-U-T-S-C-H.
Is that French?
I don't know.
I associate it with German just because it's always
okay, used. Okay, that makes sense. I'm sure you're right.
No, you may be right. But the French,
dude, I didn't even go to college. No, you are. I'm sure you're right.
Thing. Yeah. I don't know. It could be Greek for all I know, but go ahead.
Whatever. So anyway, I think that's the thing where it's like, okay, it's, well, look, the Democrats would have called it an insurrection, right? Not a revolution. Like, this is George Washington and a bunch of heroes playing flutes and saving the day. This is an overthrow. That's what Carl Gershman, who was the head of the National Endowment for Democracy, called it when he was patting himself on the back in a big speech. He goes, yeah, we sure had a great success with our overthrow of the government of Ukraine. Right?
He said that?
Carl Gershman, the head of the National Endowment for Democracy.
And so, folks, if you don't know, National Endowment for Democracy is a U.S. government-funded thing, right? That does these... Now, you know, it sets up what it would say are, you know, civil society institutions and things in countries that we'd like to become more democratic, including the kind of countries that saw the color revolutions on the periphery of Russia, Ukraine, Georgia, and played a role in, adding to the momentum behind the movement that led to the overthrow of the president. It's fair to say. So
now, who did the putsch? The putsch was led by a bunch of neo-Nazis. Now, I don't know of anyone who ever said that they thought they had a connection here where you would have had, say, like a CIA officer on the ground is the one who's running these guys and telling them what to do, or even necessarily like a guy who's been suborned by a CIA agent. I haven't even seen anyone make that case, honestly. I have seen, like, the implication is like, oh, the CIA. However, what it really is it doesn't have to be that specific. In fact, I quote in the book Ray S. Klein, who is the former director of operations for the CIA, and he's talking about what's probably CIA's most famous coup in Iran in 1953. Now, when they overthrew Mossadegh. Now, what Klein says is, well, you know, it's marginal political action in the background that makes the difference. That's the key to effective, you know, covert action. So in other words, it doesn't take like some all-powerful satanic conspiracy that controls everything. The whole point is, if we give a little bit of money to this group, we'll make sure they win the next election. If we give a little bit of money to this group, we'll make sure that they found a new media organization that we'll be able to come back and use for our interests 5 years from now, and this kind of thing. And I know, and look, I'll stipulate, there are people who demonize George Soros in ways that are just silly and inaccurate, and they say terrible things about him. In fact, I read an article that I thought was pretty insightful that said that a lot of the modern hate George Soros movement is actually sort of an AstroTurf thing, because they hate him because he's not a Zionist, or at least he's certainly not an Israel firster, expand West Bank settlements and all this kind of thing. He doesn't fit in with the Israeli Likudnik type hawks. And that's
kind of ironic
that they don't like about him.
Because demonizing him is often identified as anti-Semitic, right?
That's right.
So it's kind of...
And a lot of people criticize him for a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is that there's a history here of his involvement dating back to the Bill Clinton years. In fact, he bragged, people can check me, it's in an interview with Connie Brook in the New Yorker magazine from 1995, where he brags that he rigged the election of 1994 in Ukraine and made sure that his buddy Kravchuk won. Now, Kravchuk is now known as the guy who was... Kuchma, at the expense of Kravchuk. Pardon me for that error. He supported Kuchma at the expense of Kravchuk, and Kuchma is known now as the more Russian-leaning one. But that was a side that Soros was on then. But anyway, he bragged and boasted about his... He said, it's just like, I forgot the name of it, some kind of housing security certificate or something. He says, by my intervention in the market, I make it happen. And so he was, and he's described by Clinton-era officials in the book. I have all the quotes where they describe him as essentially an adjunct of the State Department. They say, we deal with the French, we deal with the British, and we deal with George Soros. He's a huge international player. And I'm not saying that's because he's a Jew and because he's connected to powerful Judaism or any kind of silly stuff. This is an individual human man who is a billionaire investor, who is not just a billionaire businessman, but is, in his own way, has an entire political career and throws his weight around. He is essentially properly identified as a center-left, liberal, anti-communist hawk.
Right.
And sort of like the neocons in that sense. His speciality was undermining communism in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and let me ask you, I mean,
preventing
you...
further Russian intervention in that sphere since then.
Yeah. You know, my own theory of the world is that most of the things I consider like really bad outcomes, if you look at the people behind them, there were good intentions, partly because I think people, you know, people don't like to think of themselves as these horrible people. Everyone thinks of themselves as having good intentions. And you know, Soros, I forget exactly the circumstances of his youth, but it's not surprising that he wound up kind of anti-authoritarian and so on.
Well, I can tell you, as a boy, Bob, he actually, his father gave him to a Gentile family to protect and lie, yeah, pretend he was their son. And they were the family were actually Nazi officials, and they kept him, protected him during World War II.
So he has this
traumatic.
So he grew up under the most, witnessing the most murderous kind of authoritarianism. And so it's not surprising. And I don't doubt that he meant well. And, you know, when he's paying to set up these civil society groups in these various countries, I don't doubt that the people who staff them meant well and thought of themselves as promoting democracy and were, and I'm sure worked out well, even by my light, some places sometimes. I don't know, but.
You know, that's a great way to frame it, too, because look, this is inevitable. I agree with you, but it's inevitable that if you're a billionaire and you're throwing this much weight around, that of course you're making sure that your investments are protected. Of course, you're making sure that the kind of people that you want to win are the ones who win. I mean, imagine, Bob, really a world where America goes around doing everything they can to make sure that every system out there is a perfectly fair democratic voting system, but that they don't give a damn at all who wins. And they're perfectly happy to see Islamists win in the Middle East and pro-Russians win in Eastern Europe and pro-Chinese win in East Asia. No, of course not. They're not just spreading democracy. They're spreading American power and influence. Of course they are. It's all part of it. It's all a conflict of interest. There is no liberal rules-based international order without an empire to enforce it. Mm-hmm. And then what does that look like ultimately? It means that Cargill and Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland get to gangsterize all the grain in Ukraine. That's what it really looks like. It means that you saw, I'm sure, the clip of
you're starting
Instagram
to sound like a lefty. You're starting to sound like a lefty.
All the minerals out of their ground. That's the reality of the empire.
You're starting to sound like a lefty, so I'd be careful. Maybe we should stop here.
I could clarify. Look, in libertarianism, we don't mind when a company goes out of business. We are absolutely for the process of profit and loss and failure in the market. Any corporation buying influence with politicians to steal tax money or use regulations to protect them or to steal from people in other countries is 100% antithetical to free market capitalism. That's much more closely associated with Democratic Party type quasi free market post-World War II economics. You might even call it little f participatory fascism. That's what Robert Higgs calls it. This corrupt mixed economy and world empire that we have now, which is completely antithetical to libertarianism, which is why Rothbard and Ron Paul and Justin Raimondo and myself represent this point of view of anti-imperialism to save the limited republic, to save a true, not corrupt, a true free market private property rights system.
Okay.
And prosperity.
So let me put a punctuation point on this thing, and then let's start at the beginning with the end of the Cold War.
Okay.
The punctuation point is just that for people who haven't thought about this in a while, didn't know. Okay, so the Maidan Revolution brings, you know, there had been a kind of Russia, pro-Russia leaning president. He is deposed in favor of a Western leaning leader. Putin reacts to this by seizing Crimea, which had been part of Ukraine, although it wasn't prior to the 50s, long story, but, you know, and Russia had a really important naval base there. So he suddenly feared for its, you know, continuing remaining Russian hands, I mean, among other considerations. So he seizes Crimea. And this was, you alluded to the part of the context, which was that back in, I think, 2007, we had said someday Ukraine will be part of NATO. So Putin puts two and two together and says, you know, I think I want to seize Crimea. So anyway, we'll get back to all this. And then ultimately, this chain of events leads to where we are now. But
can I elaborate on that just a little bit before we switch back?
Sure.
So I want to add real quick, and just because I know you'll love this, you'll learn so much from this. And I'm sure your audience will as well. There's an interview. You're familiar with the interviewer, the podcaster, Patrick Bet David?
I'm not, actually.
Okay.
Write me down.
He's like a famous entrepreneur or something, I believe, and he hosts a podcast show where he does these in-depth interviews. He's a really smart guy, and he did this really enlightening interview with Paul Manafort, who is, you know, Roger Stone, for people not familiar. He's basically a super slick lobbyist, a lot of times for pretty bad foreign leaders, is sort of his reputation.
Including the occasional oligarch.
The occasional oligarch. And now, of course, he's most famous for being falsely accused of being Putin's handler of Trump in the Russiagate hoax. Okay. And I'm sorry for your audience, even if they feel that in their bones somehow. Please just bear with me for a moment and hear me out. I'm not even going to argue with you about Russiagate for the moment. But the reality about Manafort is he was not Putin's agent in Ukraine, never mind controlling Trump. If anything, he was acting for America's interests in Ukraine. We did know this all along. It was reported before, although ignored. But he really elaborated about this. His job was trying to get Yanukovych to move west to join the EU, and Yanukovych was for it. Yanukovych was not just a Putin puppet any more than Manafort was. They both wanted to move away from Russia. And it's interesting, he explains that the Eastern oligarchs, who you would think are the most pro-Russian oligarchs, they actually were sick and tired of being treated like the redheaded stepchildren by the Russian oligarchs. But also, they were tired of being gangsterized when the Westerners won in Ukraine, and would, like when Yushchenko won, he took their companies away and gave them to his friends and stuff. And so they wanted to join the EU. The Eastern Ukrainian oligarchs wanted to join the EU because they wanted the protection of the rules from that level of severe corruption. And Manafort was trying to help them do that. But it was Angela Merkel's fault. She was the one who ruined the deal. And it's George Soros himself who told that to The Guardian. He blamed her, not even Putin, because of course Putin was playing hardball. But there was room for compromise. And Angela Merkel blew it, essentially, by playing too hard of hardball with Ukraine and making it essentially impossible for them to sign this association agreement, because they were going to lose so much trade with Russia on one hand, but they were going to hardly get anything out of it from the Europeans on the other. So they almost forced him to back out of it. And it was a blunder. It wasn't deliberate. But by doing that, that's what then touched off the Maidan Revolution in the first place. And if anyone listens to Manafort's interview, you'll see he sounds like Ann Applebaum or Michael McFaul. He's a total Putin hater, a total Russia hawk who says Zelensky is the bravest leader. The Ukrainian army is the bravest fighters. He's totally the opposite of what they portrayed him to be. And you can tell he's being sincere when he talks about all this stuff. It's extremely important. And then also, I did just barely mention, but I should, like, and it's in the book, but it wasn't just Soros. I mean, it was the NED, the International Republican Institute, the National Democratic Institute, and associated European NGOs and governments as well. They poured tens of millions of dollars into that Maidan revolution.
I was watching a documentary, I don't want to get too far afield, but about the Maidan revolution. They mentioned this group, a Ukrainian kind of media group, very influential in stirring up support for the protests, which, look, in many ways was a worthy cause in and of itself, leaving aside what consequences it finally had. And they had gotten money directly from the U.S. Embassy in one case. So it was subsidy from the U.S. Embassy. Now let me...
Wait, one more thing on Crimea, too. I want to add, because no one ever talks about this, but it's important and it's easy to prove. You can look it up in the Kiev Post and whatever. Kravchuk, Kuchma, and Yushchenko, the three former presidents of Ukraine since independence, all signed a letter demanding that Kiev, the new Kiev government after the putsch, that the new Kiev government suspend the Kharkiv agreement, which allowed Russia to maintain their base at Sevastopol. So it wasn't just as you surmised that the Russians surmised that 2 + 2 = boy, we better take over. No, it was an explicit threat to kick them out of that naval base. And it was only then that they seized it. And as you say too, and this is important, the Crimean Peninsula had only belonged to them since 1954, when the Supreme General Secretary of the Communist Party of the USSR, whose word apparently is gospel, gave it to Ukraine. But it had belonged to Russia. Look, I'm a private property rights guy.
If a nation
can own a land, that land had belonged to Russia since before our constitution was written in the 1780s.
Right. No, I mean, nobody noticed, because that was an intra-USSR transition. It just moved from one republic within the USSR to another from Russia to Ukraine. So nobody particularly notices. Khrushchev did that. But anyway, okay, so speaking of Khrushchev, Let's start not long after the end of his tenure as head of the Soviet Union. Well, a few decades after, actually, but with the end of the Cold War. Okay, so there's been much discussion of NATO expansion and whether it's true that the U.S. Promised the Soviet Union we would not expand NATO, you know, one inch further than the bounds of East Germany in the direction of the Soviet Union. The context was, look, we're going to unify Germany. So naturally, NATO would now encompass, you know, East Germany, what is now East Germany, won't be. And they're talking to the USSR about that and saying, but don't worry. And now you take over the story from there. What exactly was said? It was not a formal agreement, but what was it?
Okay. So, yes, this is the controversy. And the people who say that there was a promise and the promise was broken are correct. And the people who say that that's not right, they're simply wrong. And what they often do is they just exclude or perhaps are simply ignorant of the rest of the context around the question. I recently debated Niall Ferguson. Wasn't my greatest performance, I admit. But one of the things that he said was, yes, James Baker had one meeting with Gorbachev on one day, and that was a thing that happened. But that's not all of the story at all. And in my book, I cite numerous government documents because it's all been released in the National Security Archive at George Washington University. And I went and dug through every single one of those things myself. And plus, I, you know, read a bunch of memoirs and interviewed Jack Matlock, the former ambassador, and all of these things. And the story is that from the very beginning of the dissolution of the USSR, as soon as the wall came down in 89, Bush Sr. told Gorbachev at Malta, in 89, before the calendar even flipped to 90, he told him at Malta, listen, if you're to let these Warsaw Pact states go, I promise we will not take advantage of that process, mm-hmm. period. That's it. That's your promise right there. Anything after that is also extra lucky, happy wish, special, also promises, right? Like an additional protocol to the promise that's already been made. We will not exploit your withdrawal by moving into that territory. And so that was just from the beginning. Then the question of, the way you described it is correct about how complicated it was. And this is where the confusion comes in. And it is complicated. So I'll get into like the nuance and steel man the argument for you and everything. Baker kind of screwed up. What Baker said in the February 9th meeting, 1990, is he said that, well, look, you don't want Germany to be independent and maybe get their own nuclear weapons, right? You want America to stay in Germany and dominate their mm-hmm. policy, right? And Mikhail Gorbachev says, yeah, of course, that sounds right. And he goes, okay, well, so how about this? How about if you guys withdraw and allow reunification, then we promise not to expand NATO one inch to the east. That's the most famous phrase of it, right? Now, first of all, you see the spirit of this thing is important. He's trying to make it easy for Gorbachev to agree to leave. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, look, but we promise not to screw you over and take advantage. Well, of course, the problem, Robert, as you explained, is it doesn't make any sense to say, well, we're going to have the reunification of Germany, but only the Western part of it is going to be part of the NATO alliance. That doesn't make any sense. So they rewrote it a little bit. They changed it to say, okay, well, we just won't move NATO forces into right. the former GDR.
Right.
However, it was the previous promise that Gorbachev made his decision to allow withdrawal on before they amended it. And the German chancellor, Helmut Kohl, it wasn't even the foreign minister, it was the German chancellor, Helmut Kohl. He knew that the Americans had changed the deal or were trying to start to change the deal. And then he went and said, forget about that, and went with the original Baker formula and reiterated again to Gorbachev. And Gorbachev said, okay, fine. If that's the deal and you promise not to expand one inch, then I'll go ahead and allow reunification. And then Kohl went right out to a microphone and announced that Gorbachev says it's okay and we're doing reunification. No signed mm-hmm. treaty, just a handshake deal, spoken word. And he went out and announced it, and that was how it happened. And so then in the final treaty does say we promise not to move our forces further east inside Germany into the former GDR. In other words, they're still in spirit respecting their promise not to expand NATO, like literally NATO, east to in order to, because that was the promise. So in other words, it's not just a promise. It was an agreement. It was a deal, and they took actions based on the promises that the Americans made. And
it, it was kind of a handshake deal, as they say.
That's right. And the same day that Baker was proposing that to Gorbachev, he wasn't just ad-libbing. We know, because Robert Gates, who was then the deputy director of the CIA, or maybe he was the director of the CIA, he said the same thing to the director of the KGB that same day, made the same offer. Hmm. So it's clear that that was all coordinated. And then Genscher, and maybe people are mad about this, but it still sticks. I'm sorry. The foreign minister of Germany said over and over and over again that we will not expand east. Mm-hmm. And if we're not going to expand into Eastern Germany, then obviously we can't expand into Poland or Hungary or Romania or the Baltic states or any country east of there. And think about this quite seriously. If the deal always was that, of course, America can expand our military alliance into Poland and the Baltics, then what difference would it have made if they had promised not to move their military equipment into Eastern Germany? Right. Mm-hmm. They're still honoring that promise, at least as far as the German treaty goes. And then, and I demonstrate this beyond any reason in the book, because I know the burden of proof is on me. Right. I'm taking on the whole foreign policy establishment saying they're all wrong. And so I'm finding all of the best quotes that I possibly can. And I got them. And I also have a ton of great experts who've come before me, like Mary Elise Surratt and Joshua Schifrinson and Mark Trachtenberg and a bunch of these scholars who are serious academics from the fancy pants schools who did all of this work before me. It's Schifrinson who is the one, Joshua Schifrinson from Texas A&M, who says very politely, because he's not like me, but he says, look, George Bush was lying. George Bush knew that he was going to expand NATO. Another big part
of the lie. You think that is the case?
Yes, and Schifrinson says, well, this indicates some potential disingenuousness or whatever, because he's very polite. But yeah, he was lying his ass off, because the whole promise was we are not going to do this. While they're saying that to the Russians back in D.C., they're saying, oh, yeah, we are, too.
Okay.
We're going to not just maintain our dominance in Germany. We are going to expand to the east. Okay, and they're planning on it all along.
This is a good transition to a larger question I want to ask you, because there were a number of people saying in the 90s, including George Kennan, like the godfather of experts on Russia and the Soviet Union at that time, whom I actually met once, by the way. It's an interesting story, but I won't bore you with it. He was warning against it. Lots of people, Reagan's former ambassador to the Soviet Union, lots of people in the establishment were saying, do not do this because Russia will see it as X and it could lead to Y. They were doing, I think, a good job putting themselves in the shoes of the leaders of the Soviet Union. Now, my own theory of international relations is that if all of the players, certainly including the ones in the U.S. foreign policy establishment, were better at putting themselves in the shoes of people around the world and understanding how their own actions are perceived, understanding how, like, American actions are perceived, the world would be a much better place, because so often there's a, you know, like, I mean, well, let me just say, I think a number of people genuinely did not sense how threatening the endless expansion of NATO all the way up to Russia's borders would seem to them. Whereas I don't think it should be very surprising if you imagine, like, you know, China starting to send arms to Mexico, then sending some advisors and saying, yeah, they're part of our economic bloc too, by the way. And, you know, in the long run, yeah, probably part of our military line. I mean, of course, obviously the U.S. wouldn't put up with that. It's not a perfect analogy, but you don't have to be super creative to anticipate that there really could be trouble. And when I ask yourself, well, how much is it worth? What are we getting out of NATO? Is it worth it? Anyway, here's the question. I think you would agree that in the decades in between the end of the Cold War and now, there were sometimes failures on both sides to appreciate the perspective of the other. And maybe the flip side of this coin is one of them. Putin thinking, thinking this meant we were actually going to invade Russia when we weren't actually thinking that. Who knows? But I'm wondering, do you think the U.S. does more of that failing to understand the other perspective than the leaders of Russia do? Or do you think it's just like a pervasive problem or what?
Well, I'm not sure. I think I was actually kind of surprised to see, in fact, I might even characterize the book, Bob, as my collection of the Americans saying, boy, we better not do this, and then doing it anyway. And they're very kind of self-aware as they do it.
Let me add one thing I meant to add, sure, by way of transition, is the reason I was surprised by your answer about George H.W. Bush is I had always thought he was much better at putting himself in the shoes than his son, for example. He and Brent Scowcroft.
That's still true.
Brent Scowcroft had a little bit of a realist streak. Good realists are good at this. And so I'm kind of surprised to hear you say actually he did plan to do this thing that would pretty obviously be seen as provocative. But go ahead.
Yeah, no. So part of that story, before we get to Clinton, because I thought it was all Clinton too, that Bush had made the promise and Clinton broke it. It's a pretty simple narrative, but it wasn't that simple, right? It's like when Bush Jr. switched back to Al-Qaeda before Obama ever got there. It seemed like it was Obama who had made the switch, but it was really Bush before he arrived. Separate story. But anyway, part of the lie was, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make NATO a political organization. It's going to be sort of like the EU plus America. And because we don't need an alliance anymore because there is no enemy. So we're going to replace the alliance, Mr. Gorbachev, Mr. Yeltsin. We're going to replace the alliance with the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, now known as the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the CSCE. And then after that, they came up with the scheme, the Partnership for Peace. And they told the Russians, first the Soviets, then the Russians, that what we're going to do, see, is we're going to make it where everybody's an equal partner right away. You guys and Ukraine and everyone will all be in it together. All the nations of Eastern Europe will be in it together, but with us too. So now they won't have anything to fear from you. And you know, the Russians after the Soviet Union, they were even, you know, I think even Gorbachev was like, yeah, I can see why they would be a little bit hesitant to accept Russian assistance. Right. He understood how afraid of Russia they were. He even gave them credit for it and blamed his own commie Soviet Union for making them feel that way. You know what I mean? So, but then the idea was, well, look, we don't want them to be, you know, permanently afraid of you, but we don't want you to be permanently afraid of us either. So what we'll do is we'll just cast this wide net. We'll all be in a security cooperation partnership together. And they bought that. But see, that was the lie. The plan all.
And you think it was a lie.
America's military alliance. And one more thing. See, they knew, Bob, that they couldn't, that Russia was still too powerful to share power with. You know, I was interviewed earlier today, and the guy asked me, like, but the lesson of Versailles was you want to befriend your enemies after you defeat them. That's why we built up and befriended Germany and Japan after World War II, because we didn't want to repeat the mistake of World War I, where we set Germany on this path toward Nazism through this humiliating failure and, humiliating a defeat of their economy and stripping all their territories away and leading to the rise of Hitler. So to prevent that, you want to befriend all your enemies. But see, the thing is, we occupied Germany and Japan. So we can make them our friends, literally make them our friends. And if the wrong guy is in power, we'll just remove him because we got the guns. That's a different case with the fall of the Soviet Union. We don't really own and control and occupy Russia. We're not in charge of who they're going to be. So that means if we're going to truly befriend them and bring them into a partnership with us, we have to share too much decision-making authority with people who we don't pwn. And so that is too much. And so the Americans said over and over again, we can't bring them in because we'd have to share too much power with them. Expense, they're going to react. And then they go, well, at least we have NATO in case they react.
Okay, but what is the nature of the evidence that we were disingenuous? Did George H.W. Bush write in his diary, suckers, or did, Bill Clinton, or, what is the nature of the evidence?
Yeah, I have all the direct citations in the book, but it's in the documents at the National Security Archive. And then I think Joshua Schifrinson would be my best citation for in his. You can find him at JSTOR. I forget the exact title of it, but he's very much in my footnotes of the book. In fact, Bob, anyone can go to scotthorton.org/provoked/notes. And I have a PDF of all of my footnotes 6,600 something. That's almost 7,000, right around 7,900 citations, and including with hot links to everything that is not just a book, but is a link. So you could just go to scotthorton.org/provoked/books, and then just control F for Joshua Schifrinson, and you can follow those links. And he's going to be the most authoritative source on that. But I cite the original documents too. And essentially, yes, it is. We have the conversations inside the government where they were saying that the plan is to expand NATO to the east, but we don't want to tell them that. We want them to think, essentially, I'm paraphrasing roughly here, we want them to think that they're going to be in on it with us for the medium term, for the long term here, so that they'll acquiesce and we can get what we want. And by the way, and this is extremely important too, in a way it's an embarrassing humiliation for Bush and Scowcroft, but it's at least instructive for us that they wanted Gorbachev to hold the USSR together, and resented Yeltsin for destroying it. They wanted the new Union Treaty, which would have held not the Baltics. They wanted the America always favored Baltic independence, but they wanted Belarus and Ukraine and the stands to stay in a union under the control of Moscow. Bush gave his famous Chicken Kiev speech saying, don't you declare independence and rely on support from us, because I'm with Gorbachev, not with you, he said. And don't let your ethnic hatreds get in the way. And local tyranny is not better than a far off one, and all these things to them to scold them. And they said, hey, listen, and this is instructed too. They said, this is Scowcroft talking. Look, we were just trying to end the Cold War. We wanted the Soviet Union out of Eastern Europe, but we didn't want the Soviet Union itself, meaning the quote unquote republics, to go away. So in other words, to them, Ukraine is east of Eastern Europe. We didn't want Ukrainian independence. We only wanted Eastern Europe to be free. So not only would they not ever consider bringing Ukraine into NATO, they were planning on expanding NATO, but never would they have considered going as far as Ukraine. And then, by the way, Scowcroft, by the 1990s, he opposed NATO expansion. You mentioned how George Kennan did. And this is what I was saying about, I'm surprised how much self-awareness there is here, because it was Scowcroft, it was McNamara, it was Nitze, who was, was Kennan's rival to the right of Kennan, who wrote NSC 68. He favored rollback, not just containment, right? He agreed with his old nemesis. They all opposed NATO expansion. And in fact, Madeleine Albright wrote in her memoir that 2/3 of the membership of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the most important centrist foreign policy establishment think tank founded by the Morgans and the Rockefellers after World War I, to represent the establishment consensus, 2/3 of them opposed it. And they did it anyway. And they did it for parochial concerns, for what's called in libertarianism, we call it public choice theory. And it means that you don't really have a national interest. You have the interests of the men involved. And here I have the direct quote of Tony Lake, who... it's Strobe Talbot, who had warned against NATO expansion, saying we got to do it, boss, so we could take this issue away from the Republicans in the election of 96. We got Polish votes in Illinois and Pennsylvania, and we got Lockheed dollars to worry about. And so America's, the true consensus of the foreign policy establishment was put aside in favor of more rabid neocon-led agenda. Bruce Jackson from Lockheed and Richard Pearl and the neocons led the agenda for NATO expansion against the better wisdom of the consensus of the establishment at the time. And then they went ahead anyway. And by the way, as long as I'm rambling, let me say, they did the same thing again in 08, Bob. I'm sure you're familiar with the Nyet means Nyet memo.
Yes.
This is our current CIA director, William Burns, was then W. Bush's ambassador to Russia. And I have all the citations in the book. Everyone can check my work for you. It's all there for you. That the embassy in Moscow, led by their ambassador, but the entire staff of the embassy in Moscow, the Russia experts on the National Security Council, led by Fiona Hill, who later boasted about this numerous times to the New York Times and what have you, the CIA, and as she says, the CIA and the National Intelligence Council and the rest of the consensus of the intelligence community all said, W. Bush, don't offer NATO membership to Ukraine and Georgia. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, Burns writes in his memoir that he thought that Secretary Rice agreed with him And we know that Robert Gates agreed with him because Gates wrote about it in his second memoir where he slams W. Bush. He says this is the worst type of overreach. That is W. Bush's defense secretary, his secretary of state, his ambassador to Russia, the entire population of the embassy there, the entire population of the National Security Council staff, their greatest Russia expert, Thomas Graham, and W. Bush and Dick Cheney overrode them all and offered them, and Chancellor Merkel and President, I think it was Holland at the time, or was it Sarkozy? They all tried to stop him. And he did it for his own interests. He did it. You know what? Burns writes in his memoir, why did Bush do it? Against the entire consensus of, and look, we're talking about W. Bush's government here. These are all hawks to a man. Yeah. And why were they against it? Because it was an unnecessary provocation.
I mean, they weren't. I wouldn't call Bill Burns a hardcore hawk. But anyway, let me stop you here because, as you know, part of the podcast is public. And then we have some that is for non-zero members only. That is paid subscribers of a non-zero newsletter. And if you become one of those, you can set up your special podcast feed where you always get these overtime segments and a lot of other bonus content. And Scott, you've been kind enough to stick around and talk about this. I mean, we're not halfway through the story. I may have to have you back. I'm not sure we're going to get this done in overtime.
That's okay.
But I do thank you for sticking around for this, and I encourage people to invite us. I invite people to follow us into overtime, and even if they don't, I thank them for listening so far. So here we go.